It's very strange giving a Dhamma talk here. When I first started teaching, I was so used to giving Dhamma talks in a community setting that I thought my energy would be too much when I go to a retreat and everybody's all still and quiet, peaceful. Now I teach so much on retreats, I'm thinking, oh my God, my energy is not going to be lively enough to stir everybody up. I swear, mind is never satisfied with anything. So we are going to talk about the third noble truth. And I know you've probably been talking about the third noble truth all month. So, you know, I'm just going to give you my perspective on it, my take on it, you know, this truth. And for those of you that don't know, this third truth comes after the first truth, which is that there is dukkha and it should be understood. The whole point of this recognition of dukkha is not, do you know something is going on? Something difficult is going on. We tend to think dukkha is all the difficult things. So do I know something difficult is happening? Of course I know I'm stressed out. Of course I know I'm angry. And we think that's all there is. But there's something else to dukkha that the Buddha was pointing to, that he saw was beyond just our difficulties we have in life. That just comes with the package of being a human being. I mean, a virus can take us out. It's not even a living being and we can't even see it. And so it can take us out. So it's more about there's something else, not just whether we're having difficulties, because that's just part of life. And that's something else that you can begin to see once you begin to understand what dukkha is. You can begin to see the second noble truth, which is this recognition of how much suffering we bring upon ourselves. I mean unnecessary suffering that we bring upon ourselves. I mean, there's already the difficulty of being human. And then we add this whole giant weight around our shoulders, trying to somehow or another get out of whatever difficulty has come to us, or hold on to whatever good thing has come to us. And once that starts happening, we are creating more and more and more dukkha. So the second noble truth is to be abandoned. Once we begin to see what we're doing, it's to be abandoned. And then we come to this third truth, which is always referred to as Nibbana. It always has this sense that the third noble truth is pointing to Nibbana, this ultimate ending of all suffering. And if you think dukkha is difficulty, then somehow or another, you're going to think a lot like I did for years in my practice. I thought that whatever this practice was going to be, it was going to get me to a point where I was free of it, free of all the difficulties. I'd be coasting. Everything would be great. It's like a heaven on earth. That's what I thought was going to happen. And so every time I would have some difficulty, stress, something would go wrong and I couldn't handle it, some overreaction, I thought there must be something wrong with the way I'm practicing, because a good practitioner, I wouldn't have any more problems. That's what I thought the third noble truth was. But this third noble truth that we're going to talk about, the goal of it is to be realized, that somehow or another, in the course of our practice, we need to realize this truth itself for what it is, out beyond whether or not we are enlightened and we're in Nibbana or not. This third truth is something we need to realize. And that's what I want to talk about, how to go about in this realization of the third noble truth. And just a caveat here, because one of the difficulties I had with the four noble truths was that the fourth truth is about the path that leads to the end of suffering. And I always thought that that fourth truth should be the third, and then the third should be the fourth, meaning that you got to do the path to get to the ending. That's what I thought for years and years and years, and couldn't really understand why you would have to realize cessation before you'd even get to the path that leads to that. And I was wrong. The fourth noble truth is a completely different context that we're going to talk about next week. And I'll be here this week and next week, and we're going to talk about it next week. But this third noble truth is why you stay on the path. You could think of it that way. If we did not have this third noble truth where we begin to see release and cessation, we would never stay on the path. Because the path that leads to the cessation also leads to the first noble truth, which is dukkha. So we're on a path that's going to continuously bring up dukkha, that's going to continuously show us where we're clinging, and therefore continuously create a way for us to release ourselves from that clinging and then stay on the path. So there's something about this third noble truth that actually both keeps us on the path and inspires us to stay with this practice. I think of this third noble truth as where our inspiration and faith comes from. Something happens in this third truth that inspires us and keeps us in the midst of this. So I want to start with the way that Buddha referred to this third noble truth. He referred to it several ways. First, he called it the remainderless. This is the third truth. He called it the remainderless. If you look it up, this word remainder means that it's the part that's left. When the other people or other things are gone or used. So a remainderless means there's no residue. Nothing is left over. And this third noble truth actually helps us experience the remainderless. Or you could think of that as the emptiness of phenomena that happens in our lives. He called it the fading away. And you look that up, right? It says that it's something that loses its strength or freshness to become weaker, to disappear gradually, or to become less bright and gradual change. So this fading of dukkha is what he called. It's this weakening somehow of phenomena that's happening in our lives, difficulty. And the way I begin to see it is, it's a weakening, a fading away of my overreactiveness. Gradually. I don't make myself no longer be reactive. If it were left up to me, I would be reactive. I would be the same way. But the practice itself gradually fades that away. He called it cessation. So it's cessation would be like a stopping of some action, a pause or a stop. And I remember when me and Ajahn Nisabo were talking one time, and wondering what emotional energy could we say was no longer there in our lives. It was gone, cessation. And I realized it was despair. I used to live in despair all the time. I was always despairing the condition and the way my life was. But to have despair, you have to have a sense that this is permanent, that nothing's going to change. It's going to be this way forever, and I'm locked in. And that's the way I thought about life a lot, locked into these difficulties. It'll never change. It'll always be like this. I do not have that feeling anymore. I don't know when it left. I don't know how it left. But I don't have a sense that this is permanent. Nothing. So whatever difficulty comes my way, and I've had plenty my share, I don't think of it as this despairing moment of permanency. It is a moment that comes through my life. I have no idea how long it'll be there, but I do know it will pass. It will change. Something else will come along, because whatever that moment is conditional. And all those conditions cannot maintain their permanency. So without having a sense of permanency, you can't have things like despair. It just can't come, because despair means this is permanent and I can't change it. I can't fix it. Nothing to be done about it. So the Buddha called this, this third truth, a renunciation, like a giving it up, no longer accepting something, a refusal to follow or obey or support any longer. And so he called this third truth this kind of renunciate life, this renunciation of following dukkha into its difficulties. Called it the release. The relinquishment, giving up something, letting go, allowing something to leave. And this needing to no longer hold on to something, whatever something is. But it's always struck me that we give everything one word, nibbana, cessation, ending, whatever. But the Buddha, to describe something to us, had all these words to describe it. Because in fact, it's a verb, it's an experience that moves and changes and shifts. And in one instance, it might feel like a fading. But in another instance, it might feel like a stopping, a cessation. And then a completely different, it might feel like just a remainderless, no residue, nothing left here. A relinquishment, it might feel like. There's all this vastness that this third noble truth is. And we need to know that we're experiencing it, so that we stay on the path and continue all the way. There was a sutta some years ago I read that had a big impact on my realization that the third noble truth was something more than the end game, the end goal. It's called the tip of the fingernail. The Buddha was walking with his monks and nuns, just like when he picked up a handful of leaves. But this time, he had a little bit of dust on the tip of his fingernail, and he asked his disciples, "What do you think, monks, practitioners? Which is greater, the little bit of dust I have picked up with the tip of my fingernail, or the great earth?" That's a trick question. The great earth is far greater. The little bit of dust that the Buddha has picked up with the tip of his fingernail is next to nothing. It's not a hundredth, a thousandth, a 100,000th. This little bit of dust that the Buddha has picked up with the tip of his fingernail when it's compared with the great earth. That makes sense. Little bit of dust, huge great earth. So the Buddha said, in the same way, a disciple who is consummate in view, an individual who has broken through to the Dhamma, the suffering and stress that is totally ended and extinguished is far greater than which remains, than that which remains. Hundredth, it's not a hundredth, a thousandth, a 100,000th when compared with the previous mass of suffering. That's how great the benefit is of the breaking through to the Dhamma. That's how great the benefit is of the obtaining the Dhamma eye. What I think that he was saying, and it's so hard for me to even fathom this, but this is what I think he's saying. Just imagine all the suffering you've had in your life, all the difficulty, all the moments of disappointment, sadness, anger. And if you're like me, it's a lot of anger, a lot of disappointment, all of that, and all of the suffering you could have in the rest of your life, all of it is still like a bit of dust compared to the amount of suffering you let go of when you stay on the practice. It's almost like what he's saying is that whatever difficulties we experience as we are on the practice, as we are practicing through, whatever we're learning through this process, that difficulty is going to bring a level of joy that's so greater than any difficulty you could even imagine going through. And we've gone through a lot. I mean, you could just take someone you really, really care about and they die. And you could suffer a lot with that. I can't even imagine that there would be suffering, that there would be a sense of release greater than the suffering when Thaddeus died, my son. But this is what he's pointing to. So what I begin to look at, what he said, it's some things that this is the first time I'd ever heard this. This is when I begin to change my understanding of what the Buddha could be talking about in the third noble truth. And it's far more important than whether or not we reach some state of Nibbana. Because if you're looking for the state of Nibbana as being the ending, wow, we got a long ways to go. It's just a rough road, and I've been on this road for over 30 years, so if I haven't gotten that close yet, that does not seem to be in keeping with what he's saying. So this was the first time I'd ever heard the term Dhamma eye, and he's saying that this benefit of this liberative mind comes about when one obtains this Dhamma eye. That's what he's saying. There's something about if you can obtain a Dhamma eye, that alone is what brings about this great release. He also isn't even talking about somebody who is fully enlightened. He doesn't say the person has to be fully enlightened. He just says that they are consummate in view. Some individual who has broken through to the Dhamma and they have opened up this Dhamma eye. That's what he's saying. So you have to be consummate in view. You don't have to be enlightened. And you have to have this Dhamma eye opened up. And so I begin to wonder, what kind of person would that look like? I mean, that could be different. That might be doable. If I could just get to the Dhamma eye, I could do this. This is what this third noble truth is pointing to, I think. It is pointing to what happens as we begin to realize some of the things that are pointed out in Dhamma. Some, you come to these Sangha meetings, you come to, you practice, you sit there, and gradually you begin to notice some things. You begin to see some, you just let go of some things. You begin to notice that I used to get reactive around that and I didn't even blow up. I don't even know why. It's not like I thought about, hold your tongue, Tori, don't say anything. It's not like that. I just didn't get upset. I don't even know why. And there's these things that other people notice. Like you're calmer. You're different somehow. And this is what I think the Buddha wanted us to point out, wanted us to begin to see. Now I want to share for the rest of the talk here how you go about seeing that. What is it that you're actually seeing? So the first thing you start seeing is the difference between what is unconditional and what is conditional. Meaning that you could sit here and just listen to sounds, hear sounds coming and going. They just constantly change, coming and going. It doesn't have anything to do with us. There's no requirement for me to do something in order for those sounds to happen. In fact, there's a sutta where the Buddha is talking to a monk and says, well, do you get upset at the sounds that could be heard, but you don't hear them? So you're laying there asleep. I'm sitting here talking to my friend. You don't hear me talking to my friend, but we are definitely making a sound. You just don't hear it. He says, do you get upset about that? It's like, no, I don't get upset about that. I don't have no care for that. Because there is an unconditioned way that sound, your ear hears it, but you don't register it because you're asleep, you're unconscious. But it doesn't mean your ear doesn't pick it up. It's unconditional in that it happens without your making something of it. And learning to begin to see the difference between what is conditioned and what is unconditioned. What is openly happening? Things coming and going all the time versus when we get involved and either like or don't like something. So seeing this difference between conditioned and unconditioned is one of the first things you want to see. And one way we see it is through this noticing. An example would be, you can try this anytime. You just look at things. So I'm looking at you, chairs, looking at those cushions, looking at the computers, looking. Everything has a name to it. Oh, I know what that is. That's a chair. That's a cushion. I know what these are. That's the way we go through life. We know what it is because we have a name tied to it. Same way with hearing. Every time I hear something, I know what it is because I have a name tied to it. And all that name tied to it that's constantly telling us is this conditioned way that we live through life. But you could soften that. Just soften it. And just notice your ears are hearing sounds. You don't care what they hear. Just hearing sounds. You could notice the eyes just seeing. Doesn't have any, I don't care what I'm seeing, just seeing. And as you start letting the sense doors just pick up whatever that sense door is, without any concern about it, just pick up sensation in the body or sensation connected to the body, and you lose all the context that that's my ankle, my foot, my hand, my back. You just feel sensation. And you can begin to see the difference between conditioned, that's my hand, that's my thought, that's my foot, that's my back, versus just this sensory experience. And you can see that there is a vast difference between the taste of an orange and me trying to describe an orange to you. And that sense of just experiencing the sensory experience without having any kind of labels is a way to begin to distinguish between conditioned and unconditioned. Secondly, there are two kinds of releases you can begin to see. There's one release which is physical. You can make something stop. You can make something go. That's the way I lived most of my life. I would make people do what I wanted because I thought they had to do it in order for me to feel safe. So there's a lot of physical intimidation, pushing, shoving, whatever I need to do to get this the way I want it to be. And we all have that ability to physically try to control our surroundings, try to control the people around us, try to control whatever. And there's this other kind of release, because you can feel it. As soon as in this first kind of physical, as soon as someone acquiesces and gives us what we want, we relax. There's a release. We're all nice and happy. I'm all kind. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to get so upset. I'm all sweet, nice, mushy, because I got my way. And I feel so happy now. I'm all relaxed. But there is another kind of release that when you get consummate in view, when you open up this Dhamma eye, you can begin to see releases that happen that you don't do anything. They are mental releases. The mind lets go of whatever it's upset about, whatever it's trying to control, it lets go. And that release, this uncontrolled, without an act of will release, is completely possible as you begin to walk on this path. The mind gradually through the whole process begins to learn how to let go itself. It's something I teach on retreats all the time. People hate walking meditation. They hate it. And I don't feel bad for them because I hated it too. I just never quite understood the point of it. And so I finally start telling people, I came to this understanding of the point of walking meditation. Because if you have a pole here and a pole here, and you walk in between, when you get to the pole, you just stop. You turn around, you begin again. Walk to the pole, stop. Turn around, you begin again. So what you are doing by doing that simple process is teaching the mind how to let something go. Because you don't make, you could say, okay, I'm going to walk from here to the pole and I'm going to stay with every foot, every step. And in truth, we don't. We spend the whole time talking to ourselves, thinking. We get to the pole though, we drop everything. Doesn't even matter whether we stayed with the steps or not, because we turn around and we begin again. Okay, this time, when I get to the next pole, I'm going to stay with every step. You get the first step, and then you lose the rest of them. Think about this and that and this and that, and then all of a sudden you come to the pole again. And you're like, dang it. Doesn't matter, because you let it go. You turn around, and you begin again. And that act of constantly stopping, dropping everything, turning around, beginning again. That's what we try to do when we're sitting. But it's much harder when we're sitting, because why would the mind let something go? It's thinking about that. Why would I stop thinking about something I'm thinking about? It doesn't. So you have to train the mind to let it go and begin again. And the walking is what does that. Walking, simple. It's not for us. We're not walking anywhere. We are just training the mind when it gets to a certain point. Drop it. Just drop it, turn around, start all over again. And this process, people begin to see that you do your sitting, and then you do a bit of walking, and then you sit down again. And that second sit, very different than the first sit, because the mind is beginning to learn how to let something go. And over time, mentally, it will just drop things. That's that continuity of mindfulness. It just drops it and lets it go. And you begin to see over the course of an extended bit of practice, wow, the mind lets it go on its own. So that's a release that we need to learn to see. And you can begin to grasp this Dhamma eye of what the Dhamma is beginning to show. Then there's this third kind of way that you begin to notice things between the relative and the ultimate. And you begin to see that everything is on this relative, ultimate, or absolute kind of bearing. On a relative level, I could push my son into doing what I want. But on a more ultimate, more absolute, that pushing I can see does not really serve either one of us. But on the relative level, I want to try to make him do what I want. And you can begin to see that there are two, it's what Annie Lightheart calls two musics playing at the same time. There's this quieter capacity we have to just let it be, to just learn to be with life as it's brought to us. And then there's this relative level that's much more based on our ego and what we want and what we want done and what we think we need to get done and all of that. And that in between the two, we kind of balance our lives and we live in that place. It's what this actual statue is pointing to here. Usually this position is in the Kuan Yin. It's called the royal ease, is what this position is. Because Buddha has one foot down, like he's about to walk and go and do something, and the other one is up in the posture of meditation. And so there's a sense that you are both still and in movement at the same time, that you are both connected to your practice and you are engaged in the world. You're both in the relative and in the ultimate at the same time. And that you can learn to practice. There isn't this idea in the mind that I have to give up my activism in order to be a practitioner. It's more that the practice is going to help you settle yourselves in your activism. So you're not just acting out of anger and rage. But whatever you're doing both within the capacity of your ultimate practice, your sila, and the things that we're going to start talking about next month. You're practicing both within that context of the practice, and you are involved in the world. It's this being in the world, not of the world. Another thing you begin to see is harm rather than right, wrong. So you begin to see the harm of something, the harm of your own behavior, versus whether it's right or it's wrong. And I can remember how, as I became more and more and more into the practice and start growing more and more and more in the practice, there were certain things that I would not do, not because I wasn't feeling it on the inside. Like, I could get mad on the inside, but I did not want to say something, not because, oh, I better not say anything because no one will like me if I'm angry. I never really cared about that. I always thought anger was a good thing. Get your way and you're happy. Everybody's happy. If I get my way, I guarantee you everybody's happy. But what I began to realize was, in truth, the suffering I was going to feel just pushing my way was no longer worth it. It was no longer worth the harm that I would impose on myself and all the regret I would have, or the harm I would impose on the other person and all the guilt or the sense of I would never really be sure people are doing things because they wanted to, or doing it because I was pushing them into it. And so there's a way in which I begin to no longer want to do harm, not because I got this better than attitude, but because I begin to see the actual harm connected to it. So the more you begin to see harm rather than right, wrong, good, bad, then the more your world begins to move towards doing the least amount of harm and the least amount of harm you can do. There's two more here. The next thing I begin to see is this kindness. I didn't actually believe the world was very kind. I mean, I could tell. I mean, if I'm aversive all the time, I'm certainly believing everybody else is aversive. So I couldn't really believe the level of kindness in the world. And even in a state, the condition this country is in, you can say to yourself, geez, I can't believe there's any kindness out there. Maybe a few little acts of random kindness. But by and large, we're a pretty angry, pretty mean and hurtful country, world. But actually, I don't believe that's true at all. I believe the world accentuates the pain that's in the world. But that in truth, there is far more kindness. But we don't ever really see it. And we don't really experience it. But there's a poem called The Patience of Ordinary Things. Do you know that poem? It is such a beautiful poem. And it flips everything on its upside, because it talks about the love a cup has for holding tea. I mean, we probably don't think of that as love, but there is a kind of way it wraps around the tea and holds it, right? There's a holding going on. I can imagine trying to drink tea by pouring a little bit in my hand and drink a little bit. That doesn't work. And there's a way that the poem points to how clothes wait in our closets respectfully, quietly, in the drawers. You know, they just wait there. You don't think of that when you pull the drawer open to get a shirt out. You don't think that shirt has been sitting there waiting quietly, not even disrupting your life at all. We don't think that. We don't think of the window being a generous thing, or towels. She says the towels drink the wet from our backs. We don't think of that, right? We don't think. But poem is pointing to something that in Dhamma you actually begin to see kindness on a whole different level. You begin to see how much kindness there is in the world. And there is vast amount of kindness in the world that we rarely see. We just skip right over it because we are pointed towards threats and this weariness of something happening to us. And we're all so under threat that our nervous systems are on high alert constantly. And so it ignores all the kindness and beauty in the world and only looks at the threats that are around. But when you start opening this eye of Dhamma, you actually start seeing more of the kindness and you see it everywhere. So yes, you still see the difficulties, but the difficulties get balanced out by all the kindness that's around. And finally, you begin to see through this stillness that you're cultivating, you begin to see your habit patterns in a completely different way. You begin to see human conditionality. That's what I think Buddha saw. He got still enough that he could see how conditioned our actions are. How conditioned every single thing we do actually is. From how we put our clothes on as soon as we wake up to that 50,000 argument you had with your sister. It's the exact same argument you have with her every single time. But every time you argue, and I'm speaking from experience here, it feels like it's a different argument. Like this is new and fresh and this is important right now. But it is not. It is the exact same argument every time you see her that you have. Every single time. And we are so absolutely conditioned that if you look at mice and the way mice are, you would swear that's so stupid. We don't act like that, but we do. It's so bad. In this Dhamma eye, you begin to see how conditioned that is. And when you see how conditioned it is, you can't take it personal. You can't take it personal. It's not you. It's something else. And that seeing is what we're trying to do. So I'm going to leave you with this story. So I bought this. I live in a tiny little studio apartment. And I bought a table for this area that you could call it my breakfast nook, my dining room. It's just a little tiny square off the main room. And I measured and measured and measured every which way but loose, and I figured it out. And someone said, get a glass table for small spaces. It'll be beautiful. So I find this perfect table and I pick it up and I go, I'm all excited, put the whole table together all by myself. I don't need nobody. I put it together. It's great. I pick it up. I take it over to the corner. It doesn't fit. It takes up the whole space. I can't get by to the kitchen. I am livid. I am so upset. I measured this stupid table and I know it should have fit and it won't fit. Nothing. Oh my God, I'm so pissed off. And of course, I'm ready to just throw the whole stupid thing away. And I'm just going to take it to the Goodwill. Just so happens my brother comes over, he's a carpenter. And he is doing something else in my apartment. And he asked me, what's wrong? I said, stupid table. I measured that table. And I know it should have fit. It won't fit. And I'm just getting, do you want a table? Because you can have that one. My brother's standing there looking at the table. He walks over to it. And he does this quarter turn with the base. Because the table's round. The top is round. The base is square. He does a quarter turn and slides the table right into the spot. I'm just standing there looking at this whole situation. And I'm having a moment, a Dhamma eye moment. These moments are very important. So I'm having this Dhamma eye moment. Because in that moment, I asked him, how did you do that? He said, I don't know. I just looked at it. I saw it. And I'm having this moment when I realized this is how I always live my life. I do it my own way. I try to figure it all out the way I want it to be. And I don't need no help from nobody. And then I try to shove it in. And if it doesn't work, I get irritated, mad, and just want to chuck the whole thing and forget about it, you know, and do something else. And this is the way I always am. So I'm standing here seeing a habit pattern that I had never seen before. I call it my fractal moment. Because a fractal is this repeating pattern that happens over and 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 over. And that's what I was having. This moment when I saw something for the first time in my life, this kind of, that's a pattern. That is a way that I am. My brother's like, you okay? I'm like, I'm having a moment. I know something here. He just left. But I stood there for a long time looking at that table, realizing. And this is what the third noble truth is pointing to. This is what it's pointing to. This capacity to see the truth of our habit patterns, our meanness, our harms, our conditionality, all of this kind of way that we just go about in this habit way of living, this third noble truth, this constant looking at dukkha, questioning what is it, beginning to understand it, beginning to see our clinging nature to things and letting go of it. And in that moment, we can then see something that's way outside of our normal way of seeing. That, to me, is what this third noble truth is doing. And of course, when you have a moment like that, yeah, you're going to find your way to the cushion. You're going to find your way in practice. You're going to stay on the path and keep at it. And it keeps you on the path, and you'll see more and more and more. And that's the point. It's not about trying to get to some peaceful state where I'm not, everything's chilled and I'm floating along and nothing bothers me anymore. It's about learning to see the truth of how we're living and what's possible if we just let go of some of these habits. So I think I'll stop there and take a moment to just sit quietly, and we'll see what's actually coming up for you. I'll read one more quote here from Pema Chodron. She says, We think the point is to pass the test or overcome the problem. But the truth is that things don't really get solved. They come together and they fall apart. Then they come together again and fall apart again. It's just like that. The healing comes from letting there be room for all of this to happen. Room for grief, room for relief, room for misery, room for joy. Alrighty, thank you so much for your kind attention. I'll see if there's anybody that has anything they'd like to ask or share or whatever comes up for you. Oh, over here in front. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for the talk. I was, lately I've been thinking about unconditional friendliness, unconditional positive regard, and the struggle of that when thinking about certain prominent people in our society right now. And as I listen to you talk about conditionality and letting go of even just the idea of, you know, I know what a hand feels like, or I know what that sound is, I feel like I'm getting a better idea of what unconditional positive regard means when thinking about, interacting with people or a regard towards people who are difficult people. And letting go of kind of my idea, having more openness toward not knowing, not judging, not even understanding necessarily. But I'd love to hear more about your thoughts with that.
Yeah, and the other thing I think is not somehow convincing ourselves that there are no difficult people in the world, right? That somehow or another I should be loving everybody and everybody's nice and it's all sweet and kind. It's not really like that though in truth. The thing is to accept that that difficult person exists in the world. And it exists in the world, which means that I'm gonna have to protect me and mine and we're gonna have to protect people. So it's not like you walk around in this naive way thinking everybody's just wanting to be loved and there's no harm. But even people who are suffering a lot, I'm living proof of this, can cause a lot of harm. And so if you don't protect yourself from that, you can get caught up in it. And so it doesn't mean that we don't, even if we open up to all this added love in the world, it doesn't mean that we don't recognize the difficulty also. I remember when I used to go into prison and teach mindfulness and nonviolent communications, and some of the volunteers that would go in would be, it'd be so difficult because they, I came from a world where there are people that you put in jail because it's better they're on the inside than on the outside and the level of damage that can come from that. But there would be this sense of that none of these people should be here. That to me is naivete, right? So do you need to go in there and treat them like dirt because they're in prison? No, you don't need to be treating people in this disrespectful way because they happen to be in prison. But do you need prisons for some people to be held? Yes, you do. Because some people will cause a lot of damage. And so there is this kind of This is the relative ultimate that you're working with. You're living in the relative, working with what's real. And you are cultivating the ability to see the ultimate so you don't mistakenly believe that the relative is all there is. And there's something more than that. You see?
Thank you. Mm-hmm. Good.
Well, I hope I gave you something to think about. You don't actually have to talk about it with me, because I can feel when you're on the inside. I know where it's at. You want to say something? Yeah.
Thank you so much, Tuara. Yeah. My question is about the story you told towards the end about how you recognized your own conditioning with the table in your kitchen. Mm-hmm. And I sometimes recognize my own conditioning, which tends to more people pleasing, which isn't that charming because it's actually very manipulative.
Yeah.
And I've come to recognizing it, but I haven't moved beyond that.
Yeah.
Like, I keep repeating the behavior. I just, like, this week I had this behavior. Like, I'm like, I hate that I did that, but I did it. It's a habit. Like, recognizing seems to be a necessary but not sufficient step. And so I wondered your thoughts on that.
It is sufficient.
Yeah.
But you think you only have to recognize it once or twice. You have to recognize it many times. And the reason why you have to recognize it so many times, you have to see it over and over and over, and you have to realize what you did over and over and over. The reason why you have to see it so many times is because in order to experience a remainderless, like no residue, a relinquishment, a cessation, a letting go of it, you can't have this sneaky, secret wish and I could have that. You can't have that. It has to be that you've seen it so many times that you are done with it. And when you are done with it, it'll be gone. So if you get stuck in this is about you and not the habit itself, then you can see that every time you see yourself doing it, that is a whole nother layer of remorse and grief and sadness. You're trying not to get, there's no need for you to get sad about it, grieving about it. You may have to make amends. Like, I had to make amends a lot when I would recognize some anger and some pushing and some shoving that was harmful. And I'd have to come back and make amends a lot. And even a lot of my family and friends got tired of me making amends. They were like, why don't you just stop doing it then? I'm like, that's it. That's it. I'm going to stop doing it. I did not. But the point of the practice is that when you actually get to this third truth and you stop, it won't come back. It's a habit, so we have to keep vowing not to do it. Keep seeing it. Keep feeling the dukkha of it, the clenching of it, and then releasing it. And just keep doing that. And so one gift that I learned is that what you learn, like that moment when you saw yourself doing this, you probably didn't see it until after it was done.
Yes.
And we tend to judge everything by, I should catch it before I do it. But that is not the way the Buddha looked at it. The Buddha looked at it as, sometimes you catch it before you do it, sometimes you catch it in the middle of doing it, and sometimes you don't catch it to the end of doing it. But it's all the same. At some point, at the end, you go home and you sit there and you feel into that. When you're by yourself and there's no one around, you feel into that. Not out of shame and guilt, but you just want to see, what is this that I'm doing here? What do I get out of this? What am I doing to myself? What am I doing to others? And not this kind of guilt, because guilt and remorse is kind of a bypassing the pain of the harm. And instead, you beat up on you, but you're not really getting to the pain of it. And so you'll do it again. But if you begin to feel into the pain of what you're actually doing, not out of guilt and shame, just like a grown up, like big girl, I mean, look at this, right? That ability to see like that will dampen this down much quicker. But this kind of way that as Westerners, we tend to beat up on ourselves as if somehow or another, you can beat yourself up enough. That's not going to help you. That beating yourself up will actually justify your continued doing it. So what you want to do, I had to do this with my sister. I had to feel the pain of our arguments. I couldn't stop myself from arguing with her. I would sit in the car and plan for it, but it wouldn't happen. It wouldn't work. I would be in the argument with her, and I could see it and say, Tori, you really should just stop arguing. But I would not, because I had the next good point. And then I would go home, and I would relive it. Mm-hmm. Who said what? How did that happen? Then what did I do? And then what happened? And then what happened? And what happened? And then what happened? And I began to feel this energy around being angry and mad and what happened and what happened. And then I'll never forget it. I was sitting at the table and I felt the surge that came up whenever she would say something. And she wasn't always the instigator. Sometimes it would come from me. Just be clear. But in this instance, she said something and I felt the surge of rage. And I had felt it so many times sitting on my cushion, feeling into what happened. I didn't do anything. And it went back down. And everyone in my family freaked out. Everyone was like, are you going to say something? What happened? Wait, Tori, did you hear that? And I'm like, it's okay. I think in that moment, everyone was, no one knew what to do. Because they were so used to us fighting that this idea that I wouldn't fight just didn't make any sense to any of us. Not even me, but I just didn't have a need for it. But because I had felt that anger in practice, sitting there with it when no one's around, and I'm just okay, this is painful. When it happened in real time, I was used to that feeling, and I didn't have to do the automatic react. Do you see? So you want to get used to that feeling, not of the remorse afterwards, but the energy that brings you into it so that you feel it and you get used to it. And when it comes up over time, you will not be so reactive to it because you would have felt it. Do you see? That's what that keep seeing it, keep looking at it so that you get used to it. And it's no longer some, you know, thing that catches you off guard.
Thank you for this. I had never made this distinction before, and it's such an important one between feeling, you know, shame and feeling the pain. And I have been doing everything to avoid the pain.
Yes,
many of us
do.
That's
what we do. Not just you, me too.
Yeah.
What do you think all that controlling, pressure, intimidation I'm talking about? Just to avoid the pain of what I think is not going to be safe for me.
Only from you I will take a prescription of repetitive pain for solving my stuff. Thank you.
I know. You think you said, what are they talking up in there? Well, that's great. Oh, there's one more.
I'm wondering if you go to sit and wait for whatever that thing is that's going to come up? Or do you sometimes sit down with the intention, I'm working on my sister feelings right now?
Yeah, I do them both. Mm-hmm. So especially after I've had even on Dhamma talks, when I somehow get overreactive or something happens, or any time now that I have some overreaction, I'm going to go sit and sit there with it. So I'm not reliving the story. I'm reliving the feeling of it. So the story is there because it's kind of 20% in the back of the mind. But what I really want to feel is what is feeling while that story is playing. And that's the more difficult part, is the feeling of that. But sometimes I just sit down and let whatever is coming come to me, and let it be there as part of my practice. I do a practice. I don't know if you guys know about this. It's called Nine Bodies. That's my practice, primary practice. And I think Nine Bodies is a very, it's the way Philip Moffitt practices, and then he taught people. But it is a different way of practicing, because instead of using the breath as your anchor, you use consciousness, you use knowing. But when you use the breath as your anchor, sometimes that stillness of trying to find the breath is all caught up in the winds of what's going on. You can't find the breath. But when you sit and learn how to just know what's happening, and that's your anchoring piece, then whatever's happening, whether it's stormy or whether it's very peaceful, you are learning to rest in the knowing of it and not needing to get to the breath in order to get still. So that was a game changer in terms of my ability to be with a lot of what was being known. It's just a game changer on it. And so that's really what you're practicing with. So even if you use the breath as your anchor, you only want to use that breath to get yourself steady so you're in the present moment. And then you want to let the anchor go and feel whatever's arising so that you can begin to sense into it. So the anchor is really just to anchor you to the present moment. It's not the sum total of our meditation. Even though some people meditate 20 minutes, 30 minutes, and they try to stay with the breath the whole time. That's why it's so difficult to stay with the breath, because it's really to help us steady the mind. And then once the mind gets steady and you feel like you're in the present moment, you can let go and just know what's going on. So the using consciousness as your primary anchor, you don't have to do that second step of letting go of the breath and trying to be still. So that's why I like it so much. But that's one way you can learn how to do that.
Thank you. Mm-hmm.
Well, I better let you guys go. It's about that time. I really appreciate us being here. I'm